Hello, everybody. This is Brian here on New Jersey Revolution Radio, celebrating Marx's birthday with a wonderful comrade. Today, I'm joined by Jeremy Einbinder. I met Jeremy. He called in to the Green Party, and I gave him an initial contact discussion, and we talked a little bit. And what I really love about Jeremy and why I think it's perfect that he's here on Marx's birthday, even though we're not airing this on Marx's birthday, but we are recording it, is because Jeremy probably has the most solid politics in all of New Jersey. He did a project called Democratize the Media, where I was watching some YouTube videos, and he did this thing. These liberals put together this what socialism is. And it was totally wrong. It described fire departments as socialism and all kinds of things that are not socialism. And Jeremy tore that thing apart, man. Bit by bit, he would show the clip, and then he would explain socialist theory and how it would relate to, you know, these bad examples. I think another one, Jeremy, was socialist snowplows. Was that one that you pointed out?
Yeah, they mentioned snowplows. Oh, as they mentioned, the fire department, the police, even the military. The military was the most ridiculous example they could give. This is the most hyper-capitalist industry there is.
Right. You know what? Go on a rant, man. We've been following the peace movement. So they had the nerve to mention the military as an example of actually existing socialism in the United States of America because, I don't know, I can't even know. But what was their explanation? What was your counter to that?
I'm on video chat right now. Basically, that the military, basically, I think they said that anything that the taxes pay for or was socialism, and I mentioned that, first of all, the commander-in-chief of the armed forces is one person. The soldiers don't get a say in where they fight, and the military and the weapons contractors have a lot to do with the profit-making machine that war is based on, so the military can't be a socialist enterprise because workers don't control it and it's used to further capitalist interest. So, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, man, exactly. So, what's your background, man? How did you get interested? I know you've done a bunch of different projects. How did you get started in this work towards social justice?
Basically, I wanted to be a writer and a media maker for a long time, and once I figured out how concentrated control of ownership in media enterprises are, I wanted to do something to correct that or comment on it, because I knew that as a disabled person, I would be working differently than other people, and I would have a unique perspective that they wouldn't necessarily listen to, and I had the feeling that if I participated in the current social order, that maybe the companies would find a way to fuck disabled people over because they didn't have a way to accommodate us. I have cerebral palsy, so that informs my politics too, because I know that private property is one of the ways that disabled people do not have access to certain things. So I think the fusion of what started out as social democratic politics and evolved into full-blown socialist politics really informed me, and also the concentration of the media and ownership. I wanted to do something to respond to that, so I created the YouTube channel. And I'm still doing that on occasion.
Yeah, it's awesome, man. And I encourage people to look it up. It's on YouTube, Democratize the Media. And you talked about the relationship of the hardships that society puts you through as a disabled person because of private property. Can you expand on that? What do you mean by that? And how does that work?
One of the things that I noticed was, you ever see Penn and Teller's Bullshit? It was a show on Showtime like 10 years ago or something. They had an episode that criticized the Americans with Disabilities Act. not that it didn't go far enough, but that it was an infringement on business owners and that you can't legislate compassion. That was the term that Pendulette used in opposing legislation, making sure that accommodations for disabilities were met. And basically, he's sort of correct that too much infringement, too many rights for disabled people is an infringement on private property rights, because technically, if you were going to let people have free range on private property, they wouldn't have to accommodate for disabled customers. So unregulated private property, especially, but private property in general, because people don't have to build things for the sake of customer bases. They build things for the sake of profit, and it takes a lot of money to accommodate different people's needs in the current social order. So the only way, in my opinion, to ensure equal access for all is to shift the paradigm to not focus on property rights, but rather universal access.
Go ahead.
And I think that public control of land would be a good start there.
What does universal access mean? What would you describe as universal access?
Basically, the community controlling how resources are managed, people who are marginalized having a say on how towns are built, more democratic urban planning. Suburbs, by the way, are terrible for disabled people because they don't allow for easy pedestrian distances and not everyone can drive. And I live in a suburb and it's hard to get around. Universal access, I think, would be described as a post-scarcity economy. And that won't be realized until capitalism is overthrown. But to recognize these ideals and to fully push for equal access rights for disabled people is a good direction to go into if you're trying to build a just world.
Yeah, absolutely. What organizations have you come up with? Did you start out with a particular organization, or have you worked kind of more freelance?
I've been working freelance for the most part. I think that if I had the choice, that I wouldn't work as much freelance because I'm bored at home a lot. But one of the things I do is write freelance articles for a blog for the New Jersey Council on Developmental Disabilities. Mm-hmm. And that is an organization that receives state funding from the state of New Jersey, and it pushes for disability rights, and they have a blog, and I write articles for them. I wrote an article recently about how the Senate or the House recently passed something loosening the regulations of the Americans with Disabilities Act. Mm-hmm. It would give businesses a 60-day waiting period before they have to respond to a complaint, and then 120 days to respond to the complaint by saying what is quoted as substantial progress. So they don't even have to fix the problem. They just have to show that progress has been made. So all this will do is make it so that people are discouraged from suing establishments who are violating disability rights.
Mm. What is the current statute now? Do you know the current time limits?
I don't think there are time limits, but I also think that it's regularly not enforced. So that's a huge problem.
Who does the enforcing with this kind of stuff? If you go to a place and they can't accommodate you and they're required to, how do you report that, and what kind of activity takes place?
I've filed complaints with the Department of Justice before. I think it also falls on state and local governments to enforce it. I also think that people are not being reminded when they're building something that they need to have certain regulations. So when new establishments are being built, people are just converting it from an older building that didn't have to comply with regulations, because I think they only applied for buildings that were built after the act was passed. But even so, in my town, there are a lot of places that I can't get into. And a lot of times, you know, I would call a place to see if they're accessible, and they'd be like, yeah, we just have a few steps to get in. You know, they don't understand what they're talking about. They don't understand what it means for a place to be accessible.
Right.
So, you know, which leads me back to the point that property rights have a lot to do with it, is that if, you know, people in a certain geographic area had control over how buildings were made and money wasn't a factor, and people were educated about what disabled people needed, then I think people would not be as exclusionary for disabled people. I think that, you know, if I had a say in, and other disabled folks had a say in how things were built, how things needed to be built, what kind of access people needed, if the marginalized were asked first about their needs and money was not a factor in, you know, building certain structures, if it was just for the public good, not for profit, if, you know, places of public accommodation were not concerned with profit, and I think disabled people would have more universal access to, you know, social lives and be able to integrate themselves in the outside world more easily.
Yeah, because we have marginalized communities in a class society, you know, that creates these stigmas surrounding whatever it is, and disabilities are no exception. Do you feel that stigma? I mean, what do you deal with as far as, like, have those stigmas create hardships in your life?
Well, for one, I haven't really gotten a lot of job interviews, and it may or may not be because I, you know, mentioned that I am disabled in my cover letter. I mentioned that I have a background in disability in my cover letter. People that might not want to deal with that. It might, and also the fact that is that I am overqualified for jobs that I can't do, involving manual labor in the service industry, things like that, food service. I can't do that because I can't do manual labor, but I'm underqualified for jobs that are harder for me to do, you know?
What are you looking to do? Do you have a specific career in mind that you want to? I know you had mentioned filmmaking and stuff. Is that your current kind of career pursuit, or do you have other things?
I mean, for now, I'm just looking for platforms to write in. So if I could get a job with a newspaper, if I could get a job in a production company, I'd say local for now, but, you know, it's hard just doing freelance work only, and it's a little boring being at home most of the time. I still live with my parents. It's been about 2 years. That's another thing. And housing is not, accessible housing is not easily accessed for people who are physically disabled.
Especially if you can't find a source of income that's steady and can help pay for that housing. Is there assistance to help you with housing if you were to find something? I mean, are you just on your own to make enough money to pay for not only housing, but housing with some accommodations, which I would imagine probably adds to the price of these things?
There is assistance, but I think at this point, my family and I would rather see me be secure in a job before I start looking, and because I need some way to prove my independence, you know?
Yeah. Well, you're still a really young guy, man. How old are you?
25.
Oh, yeah. You're still plenty in front of you, so.
But in terms of how my work is connected to the why I connected myself with media is that, you know, I'm a creative person. I think at capitalist media enterprises, most of the Expedia, because it's privately controlled by corporations, which seek to make a profit, have a capitalist interest in mind. And I saw an article on Salon the other day about how superhero movies created a neoliberal ideology in the viewing public, because they were putting in the minds of people that, you know, oh, a hero would come and save us from government overreach. That being, you know, the one heroic individual, the Elon Musk, the Jeff Bezos, the Bill Gates. Yeah. We are conditioned to view capitalists as heroic individuals every time they give to charity, even though their existence is perpetuated by a system that keeps charity a necessary thing to have happen, instead of wealth being divided equally among the public and means of production being owned by the workers and controlled by the workers and the community.
You want to know a secret? It's just between you and me and everybody listening to the podcast. Is for the past few superhero movie years, I've been finding myself really rooting for the bad guy. I mean, you know, Killmonger in Black Panther, the Joker, you know, I mean, honestly, I found myself rooting for the bad guys a little bit. So maybe it's not totally a bad thing that the superheroes are portraying capitalists. We just have to root for the bad guys and we'll have more fun watching those movies, maybe. Have you seen the new Avengers movie?
I have not, but I imagine I'll see it eventually.
You gotta see it. You gotta see it. Dude, it's killer. It's a killer movie. You know, for somebody who appreciates the art of filmmaking and video production, it's stunning imagery and it's a great story, man. So I highly recommend it. So I'm sorry to step on your point about how horrible superhero movies are.
I wasn't saying superhero movies are horrible. Well, it just was an interesting take, but yeah, I think all capitalist media perpetuates an neoliberal economic order because it serves their interest. It's, you know, the U.S. government, the Pentagon, has worked with production companies to accurately portray military combat accurately, I think. So, you know, there's a collusion between...
Oh, absolutely.
Government enterprise, government entities, and the media to perpetuate a capitalist narrative.
We're going to talk a little bit more, I think, here on NJRR about the military-industrial complex and how it uses these other areas of our society now to promote warfare and promote the society that they want to see, which is one based on imperialism and spending money on warfare. And I think the military industrial complex has gotten incredibly smart to the point of where they can manipulate just about everything that the Powell memo outlines when it talks about, you know, corporations gaining power in our government. I think the military is using that same approach of affecting our educational system. I mean, we know the CIA is recruiting out of Rutgers, using our economic system, our political system. There was an article in Socialist Worker saying that there's 57 current Democrats with backgrounds in the CIA and other military industrial complex establishments running for Congress right now. And the media, you could see it. I mean, this is what they don't want the resistance from the public coming at them about their imperialism and utilizing the media, even to the degree that NPR is promoting these nationalistic neoliberal foreign policy ideas.
And, it's, you know, oh, you saw the thing a couple months ago about Sinclair Broadcasting Group and how they issued must runs for their local news staff of saying, you know, people get it in their minds that local news is, you know, oh, better or more noble or less establishment.
And,
but, you know, if a capitalist can commodify whatever, a capitalist is going to commodify whatever they can.
Right.
And, you know, if they can mass produce information, they figured out how to do that, they're going to do that. You know, the AP wires out a story and, you know, it obviously doesn't give the anti-war voice. It doesn't give the anti-profit people a voice.
Yeah.
They have an interest in making a profit. They have an interest in continuing imperialism. Because if they don't continue imperialism, America cannot maintain its wealth and privilege, because our wealth and privilege comes at the expense of undeveloped countries who the U.S. government has a responsibility in toppling whenever they've tried to nationalize oil, whenever they've mm-hmm. tried to, you know, nationalize food.
Yeah, the example, you know, recent, of course, is the Palestinian situation, where you have these uprisings and struggles going on, and it's almost not portrayed in the media at all. And if it is, it's a totally slanted portrayal of alleged terrorists assaulting the great state of Israel. And it's such a slanted story when you look at. You know, they don't even seem to acknowledge that the camps the settlements that the Israeli government is building are illegal. They're being called illegal by most of the world and by the UN. Yet if you were to watch American media, you would have no clue about this. Many Americans have absolutely no idea what's going on over there, and that's the fault of the media lying by omission in a lot of cases as well. I think there's a lot going on in the world that we don't know. Those of us that are involved in anti-imperialist and anti-corporate work, you know, see these problems, but I don't think the general public is aware of just how much is kept from them, especially when it comes to the world stage.
Right. And that's why I get a little discouraged when, you know, even progressive media is going to settle or even prefer a social democratic system, because with social democracy comes imperialism, because social democratic countries need to have the money to pay for their social safety nets. Now, America has decided that it is more profitable for us to for them to militarize their police and increase their military presence and make drugs illegal or bump up state revenue. America has the money to become a social democracy, but, you know, the Nordic countries engage in imperialism also, and, you know, they have a military-industrial complex also. Social democracy is not, you know, the ultimate middle ground that liberals seem to think it is.
Right. Do you see it as a transitional period, though? I mean, you know, when we talk about Lenin would say that socialism is, you know, the goal of socialism is communism. So can you think about social democracy as part of that path?
I can if it doesn't involve exploitation from developing countries. And if it involves an international effort to get to a communist order, I could see it as a stop along the way, just as Lenin had the new economic policy that was tightly regulated capitalism, but the economic growth in the Soviet Union didn't to as much of an extent involve imperialism, because it didn't involve profiting off the presence, their military presence in other countries. They were just trying to, like, defend themselves against this invasion. So, you know, I have a lot of criticisms from what I know of the USSR, but imperialism isn't one of them.
So
I could see social democracy as a transitionary period. I don't know if it's ideal. I would, you know, rather see an international effort right away, maybe international unionization, people unionizing in the same, you know, multinational corporations are a thing. I see no reason in why it can't be flipped, why workers can't unionize across national lines and give the capitalists nowhere to go to attract labor, because in all countries that the company exists, workers are unionizing for the same demands. You know, that's just a vague vision I have of international unionization.
Well, it's not that far off. I know that the Communications Workers of America have had, because that they work with telecoms and large multinational telecom corporations, that they have done some partnerships with, you know, overseas. I know that I think Germany and Brazil are two of the places. They went to Germany because of the telecom involvement, but also they've gone to Brazil because of Santander Bank and some organizing efforts with them. You know, so that's something in your, it's not that far off. It's actually happening a little bit, you know, not on the scale I'm sure that your vision wants, but it's something that's obviously happening. So that's a good thing.
What do you think is stopping the workers of big corporations from unionization?
In this country, and I can only really speak, I guess, to this country because that's where I've done, you know, my organizing work, I guess that we've developed a society that doesn't value labor. And I think that overall, the American worker has been made to feel like they're not valuable. And when you feel like you're not worth something, when you feel like you're not valuable, the tendency of your response is apathy. To just say, oh, well, I might as well just go with it because I'm not worth anything.
Right.
And I think the secret to turning around unions in this country is getting more radical, getting more anti-capitalist, but also getting more positive about work and about labor and how wonderful it is a thing to have people in this country who are willing to do work. We often hear that expression from bosses, you're lucky to have a job. You know, I think the bosses are lucky that the workers haven't come after them with fucking pitchforks yet. So, you know, and I think that's the attitude we have to develop.
As Deb said, the capitalist doesn't employ you. You employ him to take from your labor.
Exactly, exactly. Well, you know, I mean, this is basic 101 stuff for us. But, you know, it's good that some people hear it, you know, understand where we come from on the basis of our theory here. And that's the empowerment of the working class. And labor unions are a big part of that because they're centers of working class power. They're centers of working class communications. And, you know, if they adopted, I think, a more anti-capitalist and a more positive strategy, I think we would see big changes in this country. You know,
what do you think of the international workers of the world?
Love the IWW, man. How could you be an anti-capitalist union guy and not have great respect for that history there? You know, Debs is always a hero. But although he was terrible on race, if you listen to his quotes, so I've always been critical of Debs. While I loved his working class narrative, he was a class reductionist. He was totally unclear.
I actually didn't know that. I guess I'll have to do more research. But
there's a quote out there that Deb said about how the only thing I have to offer the black man is a good day's wage, just like any other white man. So it was a very class reductionist type comment. Like, hey, listen, if we're fair to everybody who works for a living, black people will be included in that too. And we can't take out race, especially in this country. It's such a huge factor in what our society has been built around, and white supremacy is still huge. Here we are 80 years after Deb's work, you know, still seeing, you know, racist policing.
Especially since, you know, cops are likely to be friendly to affluent white communities, whereas in lower income communities of color, you know, people may be likely to fear the cops. So there's a huge divide there.
Yeah, I mean, geez, that's a whole another subject. But I mean, when I was on strike, the cops were protesting the company's property, not me. You know, that's what I saw. I saw cops on the line making sure that we didn't damage company property. I don't think they really gave. They were not there to protect me from anything. Let's put it that way.
I mean, the Supreme Court, I believe, has said that that cops don't have a duty to protect people from harm.
What do we need them for then?
I mean, you know, in this paradigm, socialist and communist and people who, you know, try to attempt direct action are always going to be viewed by the state as a violent threat, as a terrorist.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But that's why it's easier for Nazis to run for office on the Republican ticket, because all they have to do is exaggerate the conditions of the natural order. But what communists would have to do is destroy it. So there's a huge difference there. And, you know, that's why the horseshoe theory doesn't have any merit, that, you know, the far left and the far right are the same. That's what liberals like to say, is that, you know.
Oh. Don't even get me started on that. Well, Jeremy, listen, let me just, I'll plug you a little bit. If you're listening to this and you got a writing gig for Jeremy, I'll give him a plug right now that this guy is brilliant. He's a great writer. He's a great mind, whether it be, you know, sticking up for the rights of these disenfranchised communities, or whether it be giving you, you know, good anti-capitalist theory. You got a great mind on you, man, and I really do appreciate you coming on. You know, I hope you continue to be involved with New Jersey Revolution Radio. If I had a job here, I'd hire you in a second, but we're all working for free right now. I'm not going to ask that from you. But, you know, how do people get in touch with you? How do we follow you? How do we know what's coming up next from Jeremy Einbein?
My YouTube channel and my Facebook page are both called Democratize the Media. DemoCratize Media. And I write for the New Jersey Council on Developmental Disabilities. That is a website, NJACDD.org.
So cool, man.
Check my stuff out on that. My portfolio website is jeremyeinbinder14.wordpress.com. That's where all my stuff is. So you can check that out. So that's where you'd find me.
All right, man. Listen, thanks a lot. And I will take those links. I'll make sure they go up with the podcast on the show notes. Jeremy, you know, I got a ton of respect for you, man. I can't wait till we see each other again in person and we can have a cup of coffee and talk more about this stuff. Anytime you have something, please give me a call. Let me know you're welcome on the show.
Thank you.
If you're out there and you're listening to us and you want to support more work like we're doing here, like people like Jeremy, you can make a contribution to the show at www.njrevolutionradio.com. We're on Twitter. We're on Facebook. I'll be sharing the links that Jeremy mentioned today. And I hope to see you all soon out there in the streets. Thanks a lot and have a good day. Good night, Jeremy.
Good night.